Canada just held elections a few months ago, but only narrowly avoided having its government fall for the second time this year. Why the drama, the division, and what is next for Canada? Let's find out on today's Trumpet World. As Canada moves incredibly quickly from elections to turmoil, I'm joined by Abraham Blondeau, one of our regular Canadian contributors from Ontario. Mr. Blondeau, thanks for joining us. And can you give us an idea of what has been going on?
Thank you for having me back on the show. And yes, I'll do my best to give you an update on everything that's been happening. It has been an interesting few months. And I think the budget vote that we just had on Monday, I think is a good indication of where the country is. And the overall feeling is that we are a deeply divided country. I'll explain this. So Prime Minister Mark Carney, he presented his first budget, the fall budget. And in Canadian government, any budget is a matter of confidence, meaning you present your budget to the parliament, the elected people, officials of the people, and then you have to have a majority vote to support the spending measures. If you do not have majority support in parliament, then the government will resign and we'll have a new election. That's a convention that's been around in parliamentary democracy. So for Carney, there was a lot on the table because he has a minority government. So he was elected and he was three seats short of a majority, outright majority. So it was interesting. There was a lot of drama leading up to it. And I'll get to the budget in a moment, the specifics inside of it. But the main thing about it is it's big spending. Carney's good at couching liberal progressivism in more pragmatic language, but all the Trudeau progressivism is still there. But the big thing is it's big spending. So the Conservative Party, the NDP, the Green Party, the other, and the Bloc de Québécois, the other parties in Parliament, they said they don't really want to support it. But you had a lot of shenanigans going on. One of them, and this is interesting, is you had a Conservative member of Parliament cross the floor to join the Liberal Party. And this is after a multi-year strategy, starting with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government, to poach Conservative MPs to join their government. So this has been a strategy years in the making, and it appears that they were just waiting for the right time to deploy it. And so they pulled this Conservative MP. There's even another MP that thought about crossing the floor too, which would have left the Liberals with just one vote shy. So all this was well-timed theater in Parliament, and it really distracted the nation away from the important issues that are in the budget. And is this something that can help the country or not? So when it came down to the vote, the budget passed 170 votes to 168. So a very narrow margin, just two votes shy. Five MPs abstained. Two Conservative MPs didn't vote. One of them is recovering from an injury, and one didn't vote because they're resigning. So very close, definitely not a big mandate for Carney to go on, but he did win the vote. So, but I think the vote shows that Parliament is deeply divided on this, and that's really representative of the whole country. It's deeply divided. Right before the vote, so on the Sunday before, the 16th, in Canada, we have something called the Grey Cup. It's our Canadian Football League championship game. My football team was in there finally after 13 years. So I was interested to see what would happen in the game. But surprisingly, Mark Carney, he did a an interview before the game. He did the coin toss at center field. And when he was at center field, there were very loud boos coming from the crowd. Here's a clip of it here.
Mr. Prime Minister, would you do us the honor? Tails has been called. This is a tails. Saskatchewan has won the tie.
So that game was in Winnipeg. A lot of Western fans there. So he's not really popular, it appears. And he is pushing through a really consequential budget. So I just want to take a couple minutes just to talk about that. So we can try to wrap our minds around why it's important.
Yeah, it's the parallels with the, just before we get into that, I mean, the parallels, I think, between Canada and the US are pretty interesting, where you've kind of got the same thing going on with the government shutdown. And the partisanship, the Brinkman, like the fact that, say, the Republicans seem to have won the battle and the fact that there was a battle has obscured the fact that, okay, the government's now funded a whole bunch of debt and people aren't really talking about that. And it's just interesting to hear you make the same point from Canada, that you've got the fact that it was so dramatic means that people aren't really talking about what is in the budget itself.
That's right. Yeah, that's a good point. It is, you can see the same kind of societal direction in both countries. You have the leaders are more concerned with theater and public appearances and sound bites than they are with, well, what is actually happening in the country? Is this something worth fighting for or not? And but yeah, I think you're right. Even the fact that I'm sure many, many more Canadians were tuned in to watching the football game than they were about the fate of our country with this massive bloated budget. As a side point, I think because Mark Carney doesn't like Trump, at least that's what he says in public. But then a week after Trump goes on Monday Night Football in the States, he does the same thing in Canada. So he's trying to copy the same playbook. It's just interesting that a lot of Trump's enemies do that, it seems. So while Canadians were watching football, this is what was in the budget. And the main component of it is spending. And it's interesting, in the introduction of the budget, this is what the government says. They say, quote, "The world is changing profoundly and in real time. We are no longer living in an era of calm, but of significant change." They later say, "The systems that long underpinned our prosperity and enabled decades of economic growth, stable global alliances, predictable supply chains, a cooperative international order, and reliable partnerships are being redrawn and constantly challenged. What we are contending with is not a transition, it's a generational shift." And so the government is intending for this budget to be a generational shift. And I don't think Canadians, they just thought, oh, this is just another budget. It's just another, drama on Parliament Hill, arguments between the two parties. But there are some pretty significant steps being taken that are really irreversible. One of them is the spending. The government is promising to spend hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 5 years. So the budget's over a five-year period. Just this year alone, so for fiscal year 2025 to 26, they're projected to have a $78.3 billion deficit. Which is the largest in Canadian history, besides the pandemic year, which is almost double what the Trudeau government was projecting in January this year. Overall, they're going to be spending over $300 billion over 5 years. A lot of that is deficit spending. The budget also claims they're going to save $60 billion in government by cutting government programs. But really, that doesn't mean a lot if you're spending over $300 billion. So a lot of spending, a lot of it's on infrastructure projects, the military, healthcare, and building housing across Canada. So the idea is if what the Carney government is saying, if they spend all this money building mines, LNG, liquid natural gas ports to ship to China and Europe, if they spend money on this, they will get more investment, and the Canadian economy will hopefully grow to cut down the deficit spending. That's their idea. But there is something fundamentally deceptive about the budget, and I mean all governments will try to show the budget in the best light possible. That's not new. But the Parliamentary Budget Office, so they're the critic of the government. They keep track of spending and everything. In the committee, he told Parliament that the way Carney is and the budget labels their spending is very dishonest. So in actual fact, what they label as capital investment, so that's investments in infrastructure and housing and all these things, they're actually mislabeling about $100 billion in the budget. So why that's important is that they're not actually spending that money on building things for Canada. That $100 billion is actually deficit spending. So the if on the graph, which I can provide, it makes a big difference, because instead of in 2 or 3 years having a surplus, it just means that the deficit will continue to grow in Canada, because they're trying to mislabel these things so it looks good, but in actual fact, it will just balloon the budget more and more, and it's pretty risky, because they're banking on Europe investing heavily in Canada and these other foreign partners, because the big shift here is they're building all this to break away from the United States. All this infrastructure, all these projects, even overseas spending, it's all done to find new trade partners away from Donald Trump's America. So it's a big gamble, but also it shows that Carney's trying to fundamentally shift the thinking of the country and kind of the long-term strategy of the country to break away from America, our traditional trade ally and military partner, and build alliances with Europe, which on the trumpet we have written about quite a bit the last few months, but even Asia, especially China. Carney's also trying to building a stronger alliance with China. So that's a big shift in Canada. And once these projects are built, I mean, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. That does shift Canada away from America. It's something that can't be easily reversed.
So are these like port facilities? Like what are they building?
So they're not very heavy on the details, but from what the government has said, they're going to be building critical mineral mines in northern British Columbia, Quebec. Also, they want to build LNG stations in like a port facility where they can load that into ships in British Columbia. Also, they want to develop the port in Churchill, Manitoba, which goes onto the Hudson's Bay, and then you can take a northern passage to the Atlantic Ocean. That in itself has been proven to be a it's not feasible because of weather, but also the Hudson's Bay is more shallow than the Atlantic Ocean, obviously. So large ships can't go into the Hudson Bay to get to that facility. So the yeah, port facilities, but also there a lot of mining that they're hoping that once that's developed, they can ship to different places in the world, critical minerals.
So this budget, it's about debt. It's about a push for Canada to move out of America's orbit. I mean, are those the two main takeaways then?
Yes, I believe so. They have they are spending more money on the military, which is a good thing, because the Canadian military has been chronically underfunded for 50 years. But a lot of, even at that, the Canadian military is trying to be integrated more into NATO missions in Europe. So even that is trying to pivot the Canadian military away from cooperation with America, and even that's more with a European model.
And what about migration? I mean, obviously, in previous shows we've done on Canada, this has been a big issue. And it's not something, I guess, that would be directly impacted by the budget, though certainly a lot of countries have used economic needs as a justification for mass migration. What has the new Canadian government done on this topic?
So the Carney government, they have promised to reduce immigration, because the government sets a target every year of how many people they want to bring into the country. So they have promised to reduce the overall immigration total from over 500,000 to around 300,000. And a lot of that are temporary workers. So that would include foreign students, temporary workers who come in on a work permit. They're not citizens. And some would be permanent residents, people who become permanent residents on their way to becoming citizens. There's a fluctuating number there, because in Canada you can come into the country and have dual intent. You can say, I'm here to work temporarily, but I intend to apply for citizenship. So you can have a dual intent when you come here. So that's what the government has promised, to reduce immigration. While in practice, that has not really happened. What the government has done is they have stopped renewing temporary workers, so their work permits, so that gives them a reason to leave the country. A lot of them don't leave, though. The government of Canada does not have an effective program to remove delinquent visa holders or illegal immigrants, people who are overstaying their legal stay here. They don't really have a means to get them out. So practically, nothing has really changed. There have been some people who have had to leave because their work permits have expired, and universities are taking fewer international students as well. But practically speaking, nothing has changed, and that's even reflected in the budget with the massive housing building projects they want to do. A lot of those are to alleviate the effects of the mass migration, and the government they still have a very robust program of taking in people who are considered refugees from different foreign conflicts. So Ukrainians, for example, even Palestinians, they can have special refuge status here. So regardless of any cap they want to put on immigration. So the government has to speak one thing, but they really need immigration, because it does, when you have more taxpayers, when you have more workers in the country, it does help hide deficit spending in many ways. It produces like an artificial GDP boost in the numbers, at least. But even just through experience, as you if you travel around Canada and even your local communities, there is clearly not much has changed in terms of immigration.
Now, as we're talking about some of these issues in Canada more broadly, I think one of the other things that I've really seen coming out of Canada are some pretty outrageous court judgments. This is a theme in Britain, in America as well. And courts have a lot to answer for pushing our countries towards disaster. So we've had was it in Richmond, British Columbia? You had a court basically saying this Indian tribe went fishing in this spot a few hundred years ago, therefore they own it. So we've got that. Then there was a very contentious case where the court changed the sentencing on the pedophile laws because of some hypothetical situation that wasn't even in front of them. I mean, maybe you could tell us a bit more about what's been going on with the Canadian courts and what, like, how much is this a big deal for Canadians? Has it cut through, or is this something that people think is okay or just oblivious to?
Yeah, I think you're right. These have been some pretty shocking rulings. And that's nothing new, like you said, in many Western nations. But I think Canada is a special case of, because we are a smaller country population-wise. And so in a lot of ways, the courts in Canada have even more influence over policy and kind of people's everyday lives. So with what we're seeing here is that terrible judicial reasoning, or even what they would call jurisprudence. So the established legal reasoning of our judges today and in our law schools are really becoming an existential threat to our survival as a country. So to start with what's coming out of BC there. So this has been a case that has been building for a long time. And this is about Indigenous land reclamation. The idea that these different Indigenous tribes in Canada, that they have a historic right to land in Canada, their tribal ancestral homeland, that trumps the jurisdiction of Canadian governments on that land. So in BC, you had the Cowichan Nation. So that's just south of Vancouver. At the mouth of the Fraser River, coming off of the Pacific Ocean in Richmond, BC, they claimed that, well, this river, like you said, we fish here for hundreds of years. This is our ancestral homeland. And so therefore, we should have legal control over it. All the titles that the government owns, or even private citizens own, those don't apply. The land belongs to us. So this court case started in 2019. So that was 6 years ago. It's the longest court case in Canadian history. And so the British Columbian Supreme Court, so that's a provincial court, they ruled in favor of the Cowichan Nation. And they say, well, it's an 800-page ruling. So it's a massive, massive document. But they say that the crown and city titles it's 5.7 kilometers, square kilometers at the mouth of the Fraser River in Richmond, BC. So that's prime real estate. That is some of the best real estate in Canada, in British Columbia. The court declared that all current titles are defective and invalid, and that the government has been infringing upon the Cowichan Nation's rights, their jurisdiction over the land. So the government appealed the decision, so that will go to the Canadian Court of Appeals and eventually the Supreme Court probably soon. But this is a big deal because you have a similar case in Ontario, where on Sauble Beach, it's prime real estate land again, on the shore of one of the Great Lakes, and another Indian tribe or Indigenous tribe, they claim that land as well, and the government said, well, yeah, that land belongs to you because it's your ancestral homeland. So what we're seeing here is, I think on its face, it's a threat to private property rights, even government property. Where does this stop? So there's hundreds of Indigenous tribes in Canada. So do they all have a land, a legal right to repossess the land they claim is their ancestral land, regardless of what has been built on there over the past 200 years?
I think one of the parties that joined the appeal was a different Indian tribe that was like, well, you guys may have fished there, but actually we lived there. And given that so many of these tribes conquered these bits of land from previous tribes, and this feels like it's a completely impossible task, like to try and then they're not just adjudicating or handing over their country, basically saying, okay, well, Canada's no more country, we're going to give it all back to these Indian tribes. You've then got to adjudicate which Indian tribe. I mean, that's kind of the meme, isn't it? That whoever possessed something second last is the rightful owner. That kind of feels like the route Canada's sending itself down.
There's a few things at play, like you said. There's no one really knows where these ancestral homelands are, because, like you said, one tribe might claim it, but another tribe said, "Well, we were there 100 years before you," or the Canadian government gave us this land, like under Queen Victoria when we signed the treaties with the British government. There is 100 different claims probably that can be made to any square mile of land in Canada. And so you're right, it opens a door where it's impossible to, if you're taking that reasoning, it's impossible to have a clear answer on that. But also it does ignore the legal fact that these indigenous tribes, they did sign treaties with the Canadian government, or at the time the British government, saying we will move to these areas that you've designated as our tribal territory. Those are signed documents. That's part of our constitution, where Canada has to uphold those treaties made with the indigenous peoples. So they're claiming the ancestral homeland now, but their forefathers did sign a treaty with the government, clearly designating what land the Canadian government had jurisdiction over and which land the indigenous tribes had. So this court ruling also ignores that whole part of Canada's constitution. But the other thing is that it shows kind of the step-by-step thinking that happens in this. So the first step was land acknowledgments, right? If you fly on a plane in Canada, you will have a land acknowledgement saying, "Well, we fly over the recognized homeland of the Indigenous peoples," before any government meeting, any sports event, any really public event, you will have a land acknowledgement. So that is just a virtue signaling activity. But here we're seeing where, okay, it's actually leading to a legal realization, where the court's like, well, no, it's not just, you can't just acknowledge it. You actually need to give them that land back. So it's a step-by-step process. Part of this too is the a big reason why these tribes can go to court and have such a strong case is the residential schools graves kind of scandal that broke a few years ago, where we've written on this on the Trumpet as well, if you'd like to go back and refresh your memory on the details. But basically, in Kamloops, British Columbia, Indigenous tribe claimed, well, they did ground penetrating radar. They found over 200 unmarked graves of children from the residential schools, which the Canadian government set up to as a school system for the Indigenous people. So that created a whole firestorm in Canada, where you had protests, the tearing down of statues of British monarchs, Canadian prime ministers, the burning of Christian churches all over Canada, massive reparations promised in forms of money to each tribe, or to the individual people who were abused. And there were that was a dark chapter in history. There were a lot of terrible things that happened in those schools. But the idea of mass genocide that the narrative took on, that is completely unproven. In fact, it's been proven as a hoax. There are no unmarked grave sites in Canada. That's been proven. So you have this really started right around the same time as COVID. You had this massive wave of national shame perpetuated by the government, the media, and a lot of Indigenous radical activists. We raised the flags of the half mast. We canceled Canada Day. We basically said, well, because of this thing, like we Canada's like we deserve that, we need to make it right with the Indigenous peoples. And so this land reclamation movement was birthed from the grave hoax. Not saying that the residential schools were a terrible thing, but there was no acts of genocide. And so that's also part of this legal reasoning, is the idea that there is the Canadian government tried to commit cultural genocide on the Indigenous peoples. And so this is we have the moral responsibility to give them back their lands. That's also behind this. So you can see how that the media and the government, these narratives that they create, we're starting to see real consequences for them that are really affecting, could have huge consequences in Canada, because this is just the start of this. So a lot of people are wondering, well, what can they just take away my house, my land I've bought, I've been investing in? Can even some businesses in Richmond, BC, they've had all funding from investment pulled out from them, because no one knows what's going to happen. So it's creating a lot of instability and even confusion, and it really undermines the rule of law, because, well, who's so these Indigenous tribes, they own these lands. Well, who controls them? Like they are their own governments within Canada. They have the right to self-government. So you're seeing Canada starting to fracture into these little tribal kingdoms. That's what this could eventually become if it's not curbed. So it could have pretty wide-ranging consequences. And I think in particular, this case made an impact on people because it is connected to their livelihood, their house, their money, their investment. So a lot more people are paying attention with this judgment.
That is just kind of remarkable. Like, this feels like Zimbabwe level stuff, the way that you're talking there with potentially land being taken away. And we saw the consequences of that in Zimbabwe. You know, Zimbabwe was a wealthy, prosperous country and became an absolute basket case full of starvation and crime and violence. And you saw that kind of land confiscation start to spread from Zimbabwe to South Africa, where you had the government turn a blind eye, or much worse, as violent gangs intimidated and killed farmers. And people said, well, you're going to see this come to other countries. You're going to see this come to the United States, Canada. I mean, and that felt like massive exaggeration. And kind of like, well, that's entirely unrealistic. But it kind of looks like those people were right. Like, if you've got now courts saying this land that was a wasteland that you have now invested in and you have transformed and you have made prosperous through generations of blood, tears, toil, and sweat, actually, at the drop of a pen, we're going to hand this over. Like, you are completely undermining property rights, rule of law. These things are the foundation, not just of prosperity, but of peace and safety. So you start taking away that, you're removing the foundational pillars of civilization. Now, I guess it's appealed, and there was more nuance, I think, to this ruling than simply this needs to be handed over to the Indians. It was kind of more along the lines of there needs to be some compensation in some form for them, and we'll try and sort that out over time. But it really is remarkable to see Canada potentially going down that route. And certainly you'd hope it's so crazy that somebody slams the brakes on and they start going into reverse very quickly, because you know, you don't need much insight or foresight to see that this is going in the way of absolute disaster. But then I wanted to add some of those comments before you got into that other ruling that came from Canada's Superior Court.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, no, I think that's a great tie to make, because with these land reclamations, we have a historical vivid example of where this leads, like you said, in Zimbabwe. And we don't want to be naive about how these things, it starts with the land acknowledgement, but it could end in just the dissolution of the rule of law in our country. And so along those lines, so that's one way the courts are undermining the pillars of civilization. But here's another one. And this is with the Canadian Supreme Court. So this is where the Supreme Court, they struck down the statutory minimum sentencing on possession of child pornography. So the law did state there is a 1 year minimum mandatory sentence if you're caught for possessing child pornography. But the court struck that down in this ruling. Now, what they didn't do, they did not, this isn't legalizing child pornography. This is not saying you will not be sentenced if you possess it. There's still a penalty for it. But they did strike down a 1 year mandatory sentence. So I'll try to explain this, because it is, I think the media's misrepresented it, but also they don't want to talk about the real issue at play. So the reason this came to the Supreme Court is because two men in Quebec, they appealed their charges for possession of child pornography. So just to tell you what's at play here is, so these two men, one possessed close to 500 files, hundreds of images of children. Some of them were between the ages of 3 to 6 years old. This absolutely revolting things. And then the other man in this case, he possessed hundreds of videos of pictures of children as well. So just some of the worst stuff you can imagine. And so these men, they were sentenced. The man who had more of the content, he was sent 90 days imprisonment and 24 months of probation with conditions. And then the other man, he was sent for a 9-month term of imprisonment. He also distributed it, so that's a higher offense. 1 year because of distribution, and then 24 months probation. So that's what they had before the appeal. Now, nothing changed in their sentencing. So these two men, nothing changed in their sentencing, even though the government struck down the 1 year mandatory sentencing. So on the face of it, I mean, that's not a lot of punishment for some very evil sins, without even bringing in what the Bible thinks about these sort of sins. I mean, just child pornography is a disgusting thing that should not be tolerated at all in our nations. But the men, they appealed it because they thought, well, this is cruel and unusual punishment, like how we're being sentenced here. And so the even more disturbing than some of these other things is that the Supreme Court agreed with them. They said, like, well, in some scenarios, 1 year mandatory sentencing for possession of child pornography is cruel and unusual. And so they didn't consider any facts about what the actual case was, these two men having hundreds of pictures of evil, nor did they get into, well, how did these men possess these things and kind of the industry behind that. But they just the whole judgment revolved around this hypothetical scenario where, okay, well, if you have the a set an 18-year-old who has a 17-year-old girlfriend and she shares inappropriate pictures of herself with him, and he shows it to a friend who's a minor, who a 17-year-old friend. Well, then that 17-year-old just looked at child pornography, and then he should go to jail for a year. Now, that it's a hypothetical, and that it's a kind of a ridiculous reasoning to use when we're dealing with the sort of the abuse and evil towards children. But what this case does is that it does normalize pornography. What I mean is the court says that they accept the fact that teenagers and young people share pictures of themselves, sexually explicit pictures with themselves normally. That's just the way young people are today. And so they don't want to keep this 1 year mandatory sentencing in place because they think it will be, you'll end up with a bunch of teenagers going to jail because they're engaging in this sort of behavior. That's at the core of why they change the sentencing. So, I think that there should be much, much stronger, action taking against any pornography, especially child pornography. I mean, even a 1 year sentence doesn't seem that very strong. But the fact that the Supreme Court of Canada, it was a 5-4 decision, so it was split almost halfway. But the Supreme Court said, like, well, pornography is so prolific in our societies and our young people that we cannot have laws like this because it will, you'll end up getting a lot of young people in jail for something that society accepts as normal. And I feel like that's a huge admission for the Supreme Court to make. They are saying that Canada has lost the war against pornography, against the over-sexualization of our young people. Set aside child pornography, that is evil and satanic in itself, but even in how promiscuous our society is, and that there is the normal morality and the idea of sex is for marriage between two married people, that is completely gone from the idea, from the fabric of Canadian law. That biblical value, the biblical laws of marriage and family, those are not even present in the reasoning of the Supreme Court. And so just to summarize what I've said, I feel like this is very important because the Supreme Court of Canada, they are a teacher. What the Supreme Court condones is what teaches people, okay, well, this is acceptable behavior. That is, the courts are also teachers in that way. So the fact that they say, well, pornography and sexual deviancy and promiscuity is so much a part of youth culture that we have to strike down this law for pedophiles and people who hold child pornography says something pretty terrible about our country, and that they're willing to accept that as a fact. They're not even trying to make laws to push against that trend and that decline in our society.
Yeah, that's a good point. And this does go so much further than, I mean, I almost said just child pornography. I mean, that it's not even that is like, this is a serious issue. The normalization of pornography, that's, like you say, that's the foundation of family, that courts are now ruling according to their whim and kind of watering down the laws to match their perceptions of the standards of society. I mean, this is all pretty basic constitutional stuff, even from a government perspective, like that courts don't make laws. So, yeah, just another massive curse for Canada. I think Canada's also been afflicted with some of the same things that we've seen in the UK and probably any country that's had mass migration, which is you've got a lot of people more loyal to their own sets of beliefs than they are to the new country. I mean, maybe that even ties in with this pornography case. But another way that this kind of manifests itself, this high migration, is all of these Palestinian flags everywhere, a kind of a large segment of people, or a very vocal segment of people within Canada. We see it within Britain, supporting the terrorists in Hamas. And this is something that, as I understand it, in Canada, has infiltrated the government as well, to the point that you've had Palestinian flags flying off of government buildings. And certainly Canada, and shamefully the UK and France, you know, we've sided with the terrorists, with the baby murderers, against the people trying to defend themselves. And that's been really revealing about the state of our countries.
That's right. And I think you can see how all these different stories, they do, when you put them all together, they do give a broader trend of how each of these are contributing to the direction of the country. A few weeks ago, I did write an article on thetrumpet.com called "Welcome to Canada, Stan," which can give some more context to these stories. But what we're seeing is, like you said, we're seeing with this mass migration of people, when they come into Canada, they've been here for a long time, and they're establishing these large diaspora populations that do not have any intention of integrating into Canadian society, or even adopting the values of Western civilization, but rather they're trying to build their own society that they've taken from their homeland and bringing it to Canada. And so this includes their views on morality, religion, family, anything, like you said. So this undermines Canada, because no, we can't claim that, well, Western civilization, biblical values that civilization is based on, those are the best. We can't, which is most nations, they're based around ideas, and they have those ideas because they think those ones are the best. So they're saying, we're going to use these ideas. But that's not the case in our Western nations today. I think Canada is is on the tip of the spear when it comes to this, where we declare, like, well, all values are equal. We can't say one value is better than the other. And so what we're seeing practically from these policies over the years is now we're seeing the division in our society because of these values that we are equally promoting, but they're not really being equally promoted, as I'll talk about in a second. So what you mentioned about the Palestinian flag being raised in cities across Canada, so the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, so it's a NGO group in Canada. They push a lot of city halls and even provincial legislators to raise up the Palestinian flag on the anniversary of the Palestinian Declaration of Independence, which was 37 years ago. So city halls in Toronto, Calgary, many cities across Canada, they raised the Palestinian flag. And so you had a lot of Jewish groups try to stop it because they're saying, well, you're basically 2 years after a genocide of Israelis. You're raising the flag of the people who did it against them. And it's just unbelievable. And so you have, it's clearly the government is taking a side, right? That they are, they're saying, well, we want to protect these values, this diaspora. And so in Canada, you do have a large Arab diaspora, especially in Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. And they are very influential. They do decide the outcome of elections in several important ridings. And so that's why these governments are doing this, because they need the vote. But also you just have a larger trend where just there isn't the courage or the ability for even the government to protect the Jewish population. Anti-Semitic attacks in Canada, almost every day a church, or sorry, a synagogue or a Jewish school is attacked. Bullets are shot at it, fire bombs, graffiti. There's several cases in school systems where the teachers are from, they're immigrants from Arab countries, and so that they will attack and humiliate Jewish students in the school. And the school board tells the Jewish students, well, you should find a different school or you need to stay home. So it's unbelievable what's happening with just that one area, but you have just overall where society just accepts it. There isn't a large pushback. There aren't any protests over these things. And you have other groups. You have large, I guess in November 23rd, there's a big referendum on Khalistan. And so whenever there's these big, Khalistan is the movement to have a separate Sikh state within India. So India is mainly ruled by Hindus at the moment. And so the Sikh, a different religious group, they want to create their own state in India. So you have large Sikh populations in Canada who are very pro-Khalistan. A lot of Khalistani terrorists migrate from India to Canada and have safe haven here. So you have a very large activist group in Canada of pro-Khalistanis, and they're very politically active. And so you have these massive rallies. You had some near Toronto the other day, and it creates a lot of tension because this is an ongoing religious war in India going back hundreds of years. And there's been a lot of terrorists and recent violence over this tension between the Hindus and the Sikhs. Not all of them, but there are some who want to fight a war over this. And so that tension is also in Canada. And there's just more and more cases where protests become violent, or you even have assassinations of pro-Khalistani dissidents in Canada by the Indian government, and vice versa. So it's a very it's a situation where any of these tensions can explode any time. You have the Arab and Jew conflict, Sikh Hindu, you have Russian Ukrainian, you have all these different conflicts in the world that are being brought into Canada. And it's just another way where, as we undermine our own rule of law, right, our own idea and sovereignty over our country, our own ownership over our country, our rights, our traditions, our biblical history, the more we let go of this, the more others come in and they take advantage of it. They whether it be people who have who want to commit evil and the courts won't do anything to stop them, whether it be land reclamation threatens to take away the land that's been developed in the nation, or whether it's diasporas who are coming into conflict with each other in Canada and changing our values through through their political influence and also through immigration. What, however you look at it, all of this is changing Canada. We're a deeply divided country, and it's year by year, it's changing our nation from being a Judeo-Christian country just to being a mosaic of diasporas, an amoeba where you can't really define what Canada is.
Yeah, division on so many levels. Division, I guess, between left and right, to the point they can't get anything done within the country with the budget, but then division within people that are more loyal and more bound up in political developments in countries overseas. You know, we've got a similar situation in the UK where you've got some MPs spend more time working and campaigning for an airport to be built in some region of the Punjab in Pakistan than they do on things that affect the local people where they were elected. And really, that's because the local people that where they're elected care more about an airport in this particular part of the Punjab than they care about what's going on in Britain. Because then they're not loyal to Britain and they don't really have much interest in what happens there. So these are all, I mean, these are all curses. These are all self-inflicted curses in almost all cases. But we're seeing, you know, we're seeing Canada cause itself a whole lot of problems.
That's right. That's the astounding thing is it's all by our own decisions. And some of these decisions are, I think a lot of them are made in ignorance or under pressure from other groups. It's for self-interest, like short-term gain, political gain. But some of it is long-term strategic change that some of our leaders want. Are use division to cause change in Canada, but it's all self-inflicted. And this, what the most astounding thing is, if we take a step back from the news and we've tried to paint a picture of these different issues and where they're bringing the country, but if we step back and try to explain it, it's astounding how accurate Bible prophecy is. It's astounding how God predicted this would be the exact state of our nations in this in these end time. And so to understand this, the first place to start is to understand the late Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that explains the biblical identity of modern nations, and he proves in there that Canada is a descendant of the tribe of Ephraim. And Ephraim was one of the tribes of Israel that God gave a birthright blessing to of greatness and prosperity. So when we look at Britain, the British Empire, Commonwealth, which Canada is part of, the reason why we have physical blessings, peace, security for the last 200 years. Is because of these biblical promises. And so it's important to understand that God gave these promises to these nations, not because of our righteousness, but because God was keeping a promise to Abraham, the forefather of Israel. And that's important to contemplate. Well, why did God give these promises to Israel? Well, it's because he was obedient. He strived to obey God's laws. He had faith in God's promises. And so it wasn't because of his skin color or his these other reasons why God gave these promises, is it was his obedience, his faith to God's way of life. And so there's a very dramatic quote in the United States and Britain in Prophecy where Mr. Armstrong says, well, God had to keep this promise to Abraham. And so he gave it to us thousands of years later. We weren't following after the way of Abraham, but God gave it to us because of Abraham. But once God gives a blessing, it's up to us to keep it. Our morality, our behavior, our decisions decide whether our nations will continue to be blessed or whether we will be cursed. It's very simple. Bible's very simple on there's two directions. And so what we're seeing here is these self-inflicted curses are, we are choosing to give away our blessings because of disobedience. We don't believe in the Bible. We don't believe in God's promises. We don't obey God's commandments. And so we see where God gave the descendants of Abraham this land as a blessing, but now we see where in our courts we're giving it away. We see where God gave us these blessings, but then we use them to commit just terribly satanic evil. We actually allow and promiscuity and terrible sins to grow in this country. And we don't, the courts aren't even trying to stop it. We just accept it, and we just have to live with it. And then we allow other nations to come in and change the country instead of holding to the values that God has in the Bible. We promote all values are equal, which actually means that we denigrate biblical values. And so the Bible predicted all of this, and it's all explained in the United States and Britain in prophecy. That will give you the big picture. But God specifically said these different trends would happen in our nations, in Canada, in the United States, and Britain in particular.
I mean, one verse that just stands out to me as we talk about all of this is Hosea 13 and verse 9, a book that's all about Ephraim, that says that, "Oh Israel, you have destroyed yourself." And that is what we've been doing in so many ways. These are all choices. These are all decisions that we've made, and we're causing all of these problems. But then it ends with that same verse, "But in me is your help." And that's the wonderful thing about the United States and Britain in prophecy, about the book of Hosea, that, you know, they make clear that we are causing our own problems, and then God is adding on additional curses and additional punishment, but he's adding on that additional punishment to turn us around. And some of these stories, you look around and you kind of think, well, like, how do we ever recover from this? And the hope of the United States and Britain and prophecy, the hope of the book of Hosea, is that this isn't the end. It's not necessarily recoverable in that we're not going to just go back to, this isn't about turning the clock back 10, 30 years to when things were a bit better when they are now, but we still had very real problems back then. It's about God using these curses to wake us up, and God creating a whole new society, and one in which everyone can see the truth, everyone can be blessed. And so it's not the end of the story for Britain, for Canada, for the United States, for any country around the world. And these books also just make that wonderful hope very clear as well.
That's right. And that's the exciting thing is it's easy to focus on the doom and gloom, or it's easier to point out problems than to give solutions. But God's not like that. God works from the solution. God has a solution. And so I think one big lesson we need to take away, like you said, is we can't trust in man. Doesn't matter who that man is. That's Jeremiah 17 says, "Cursed be the man that trusts in man." We have to put our hope in God. We have verses like Isaiah 3 verse 12, which says, "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths." So whether it's we allow family issues to rule over us, right? We allow broken family laws, sin to rule over us. We, our leaders lead us away from God's truth. And we can see that with some of the stories we talked about today. Our leaders are leading us away from the biblical solution. Another one is Micah 3 verse 1, which says, "And I said, hear, I pray you, O heads of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel. is it not for you to know judgment? So God is saying, well, the leaders, the judges of our nations, you have this history with God. Like, shouldn't you know judgment? Shouldn't you know how to lead the people towards God? But they don't. And so the solution isn't looking to a human leader, nor is it looking within ourselves. We can't ignore these things, but God offers the solution. And the solution is we have to look to God, just like Abraham did in the Bible, all the individuals of the Bible. Even God's always working to bring about individual repentance, which that not all that leads to national repentance, change of heart, change of direction. And because God's not trying to restore the British Empire, he's not trying to bring about the American superpower, like you said, or, you know, restore Canada to Confederation in 1876. He's not trying to do that. God is preparing for a new world. God's, like Jesus Christ said, the kingdom of God is at hand, right? The king, a literal government with God, having righteous government, righteous judgment, teaching people about how to be happy by obeying his laws. That is the solution. And when we repent, we can be a part of that. And we can avoid having to learn through punishment or the consequences of mistakes. We can learn by having faith and obedience. So that's the message God has for our nations now. But it is hopeful to look to the future and realize, well, all these things that are happening in our nation now, it's a sign that it's not that the solution is coming very soon. And we don't have to wait much longer until God personally intervenes and he does implement the solution to all these issues that we talked about today.
And you can learn much more about that in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. It's such a great introduction. You know, if you've been listening for the show for a bit, you want to dive in more deeply, you want to prove some of these things for yourself, United States and Britain in Prophecy is a fantastic starting point. And that's on our website, thetrumpet.com. We would be very happy to send that to you for free. You can read it online, but however you read it, I just really encourage you to read it alongside your Bible. Turn to the scriptures, prove these things for yourself from the Bible, use this book to draw you more deeply into the Bible. That's really what it's there for. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. And all of our material is sent to you completely free with no follow-up, no obligation. We don't chase you down for donations or anything like that. We just want to get this out to the largest audience possible. Well, thank you so much to Mr. Blondeau for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And thank you to George Haddad for engineering and production. We will, if you have any questions or comments, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'll be back on Friday with our regular Week in Review show. Until then, keep watching your world.